Good morning, everyone. We're going to start the third day of our summer course. And for us, it's a pleasure to open this third day with Professor Steve Fuller from Warwick University of Warwick. And let me see my notes. So he's professor at the University of Warwick at the Department of Sociology. He's one of the founders of. He's one of the founders of the field of social epistemology. He founded the journal of the same name in 1987, Social Epistemology, and wrote the first book about the topic, also the name Social Epistemology, in 1988. Social epistemology could be characterized as a cross-disciplinary research that approaches scientific knowledge as an intrinsically social activity and provides normative arguments about the means and ends of science and its role in society. Professor Fuller was awarded, just a few things about his career, was awarded a higher doctorate by Warwick University in July 2007 for recognition of published work or papers which demonstrate a high standard of important original work, forming a major contribution to a subject. He has been a visiting professor in several universities around the world. In 2011, the University of Warwick appointed him to the August Comte Chair in Social Epistemology. In that same year, Professor Fuller was appointed a fellow of the UK Academy of Science. In 2012, he was appointed to an honorary professorship at the Dalian University of Technology in China. He has published 17 books, more than 60 book chapters, and more than 150 academic papers. His works have been translated into 15 languages. So, welcome, and thank you for being here. And his talk is How Science Has Changed the Structure of Politics from a Dominant to Any Future Ideologies.
Okay, thank you. Let me see if I... Yes, this is okay now. Okay. I'm actually recording this, I just warn you, those of you who are going to speak and so forth, but I don't mean that as a threat, but it's just, I find it very useful actually to hear what exactly I say when I'm being asked to speak on these topics. Let me start by saying something a little bit about my background. I'm always amazed that if people know who I am, they know me for various reasons. And what I want to do is I want to provide a context in which I'm talking about this topic here. As was noted in the introduction, I'm primarily known as this person who established the field of social epistemology, and that's of course true. And I've done a lot of things over the course of my career in relation to that. One of the things that I think makes me very relevant to this conference is whatever I've done has always transgressed boundaries. Okay, while I do think of myself, if you ask me for a disciplinary affiliation, I have been a professor of sociology in the UK since 1994. In fact, my PhD is in history and philosophy of science, and I do think of myself, and I think it's most reasonable to think of me as a philosopher, as a kind of curious, strange maybe philosopher, and that's why I sort of like the idea of having the chair that I hold, Auguste Comte. Okay. But I do think, and at the end of the day, this is about philosophy, and it's about foundational questions about the nature of knowledge and reality and so forth. And I do think that a lot of the topics that have been flagged here so far, especially with regard to the issues of normativity, are quite relevant to what I want to be saying. Now, we normally, certainly in the modern period, in the period after Kant, there's been a tendency to distinguish epistemology from ontology, the nature of what we know from the nature of what is. And I think that that's a very difficult... I mean, there's an analytic reason for wanting to have it at the distinction, I understand. But I do think that at the end of the day, if we're talking about, especially if we talk about the kind of knowledge that we have as human beings, and especially in terms of our capacities for rationality, objectivity, all of these things that traditionally separate us from other animals, that there's a sense in which we're forced back into the ontological questions, or at the very least, into the kinds of issues in the early 20th century were called philosophical anthropology. I mean, this is a kind of phantom field, you might say. It doesn't really exist, but some people talked about it for a while. But I do think, in a sense, we're forced back into what is it about our nature, in particular, and the important point, I think, from the standpoint of those of us who think of ourselves as naturalists, is, okay, naturalism is normally committed to a view that animals and other entities are embedded in the world and their knowledge is relative to that world, but nevertheless, human beings have aspirations to knowledge of everything. Okay? And it's that totalizing aspiration that makes human beings very curious as creatures. Okay. And so, you know, so if you were, as it were, a sort of Darwinist from Mars coming in and looking at human beings, you would see human beings as profoundly irrational. Because, in fact, the forms of knowledge that we value the most and we spend the most money and investment in are things that go way beyond the environmental context in which human beings can reasonably be thought to survive. In other words, if we are going to be surviving in other places, in the extended universe, over space and time and so forth, we would have to become quite substantially different beings from a material standpoint from the beings that we are now. But nevertheless, I think that does define our humanity, actually, is that kind of naturalistic craziness. Okay, so I'm not saying this is some sort of refutation of science or anything, but if you want to, you know, people who advance the idea that science is the supreme form of knowledge or the most advanced form of knowledge, they're not just talking about the fact that science enables us to adapt to our environments well, because you don't need science for that, actually. And I think environmentalists are constantly reminding us of that fact. But what makes us distinctive as human beings is the fact that we transcend those environmental constraints in terms of at least our aspirations. And that we want to know about and possibly live in places that have nothing to do with the natural environments in which we normally are embedded and which would be the most probable places for our existence given our current material form. Okay, so there is a sense in which if one really takes naturalism seriously and one, as it were, acts reflexively about it and say, well, okay, naturalism is identifying us in a certain way in a certain world, one wonders, well, okay, but then in some sense this naturalistic picture doesn't really capture us as we think of ourselves as beings distinct from other animals. And so this is where all these projects of self-transcendence come from. And of course, theology has been the most historically prominent one, is certainly in the Western tradition, with regard to thinking about human beings as creatures created in the image and likeness of God, where God is occupying a position, the view from nowhere, which is the view from which physics operates. And insofar as physics is the primary science and is the kind of aspirational form of knowledge, right, then there's a sense in which we're imagining ourselves as potentially like that sort of being who could actually have that sort of knowledge. And I think we need to take that quite seriously. But of course, those kinds of aspirations aren't just limited to the theological realm. They're also involved in the political realm. And it's the idea that we can organize humanity, we can organize the earth, as it were, from a kind of godlike perspective. A kind of planning perspective. I actually support this viewpoint. Okay, so everything that distinguishes humanity from the rest of nature, I am very supportive of this. Theology has traditionally provided the way for this. It's not obvious to me that theology is going to provide the way in the future, but the point is that if if we sort of take the naturalistic argument at face value and say we're just another animal that in a sense is genomically different by, what, 1 or 2%, okay, and that we're just, you know, in a sense creatures trying to adapt to environments just like other animals are and so forth, then there's a sense in which all of this kind of more high-blown stuff, this sort of self-transcending stuff, just doesn't make much sense. or at least it seems incredibly risky. And in fact, historically has been incredibly risky. Okay, so whenever human beings have thought that they could control the universe, all kinds of disastrous things happen. Now, there are two ways to think about this fact. And the 20th century, in a way, provides the track record for this. And this is why so many people have turned off to science. You can either say, okay, the 20th century basically shows, no, we are not these self-transcendent creatures who in some way are radically different from other animals, and so we should get real, in a sense, and become proper Darwinists and realize that we live on a planet as material beings, just like all the other animals, and that our marginal differences, while they might be fascinating to us, so we might like the fact that we can think about all kinds of crazy things, they do not have ontological consequences. It's just fantasy. Keep it in fiction. Okay? And maybe our computer technology will enable us to contain that kind of impulse. But it isn't substantial from an ontological standpoint. We should not take that too seriously. I don't hold that view. I actually think that, in fact, what the 20th century provides is, in a sort of Popperian sense, kind of various sorts of falsifications of different ways in which one might think about self-transcendence. And that there are lots of things to learn from this. Lots of things to learn. But it doesn't stop the project. After all, science does not stop when you have falsifications of particular hypotheses. Science continues, but they change the hypothesis. And I think this is a similar thing that we should think about at an ontological level with regard to the kinds of political consequences that have been done in the name of science, whether we're talking about the atomic bomb or the eugenics projects or any of these atrocities, the environmental despoliation, all of these things that I think are quite legitimately laid at the doorstep of science as having been very intimately involved in, do not necessarily invalidate science or invalidate our identification with science. But it does require that we learn from the experience. Okay? And that's the tricky part. What does it mean to learn from the experience without invalidating it? And I think that's kind of the issue where, in a sense, we're faced with today. This is the backdrop, you might say, from which I'm talking about the sort of shift, you might say, in political ideologies that are happening in our time. Because I do think they are, in a sense, reflections on what do we learn from science's increasing involvement in public life, in politics, over, let's say, the last 200 years since the Enlightenment. What is the lesson to be learned, and where do we go from here? I began to argue this in a book that came out last year called Humanity 2.0. I've got another book coming out before the end of this year called Preparing for Life in Humanity 2.0, where I do think there's a sense in which the science side of this is pushing the argument. And then there's another book coming out co-authored with Veronica Lipinska called The Proactionary Imperative. And that's kind of, in a way, reflecting the way in which I think the ideological poles are shifting in the new century. Okay? And I want to talk about what, you may not know what this term proactionary means, and I want to talk about this as a kind of ideological position, which is a position which me and my co-author identify with, against the alternative. So as it were, the new left and new right. I see the proactionary as the new left, you might say, but it's not quite the left as we knew it in the past. But the alternative, the other position I see, which is already more established, is precautionary. Okay? And some of you, those of you who are familiar with the politics of the environmental movement and so forth, will know about the precautionary principle. And it's a kind of a cause no harm principle with regard to issues of scientific development and technological innovation and so forth. Namely, we do not introduce things that we think might cause some harm. So as it were, it's a very risk-averse strategy, precautionary principle. Whereas the proactionary principle, and this is a principle that was coined only in the year 2004, by people who identify themselves with the transhumanist movement. Okay, and these are people who, in a sense, think that that actually the most efficient way of becoming self-transcendent is by re-engineering ourselves in a very fundamental way, whether we're talking about genetically or perhaps in terms of shifting the bases of our consciousness from a carbon base to a silicon base. You know, if you know about Ray Kurzweil and the singularity movement, people of that kind, okay? So transhumanism is a kind of broad church, you might say, of people who in a sense believe that to be human is in a way to be, you know, always already dissatisfied with your current embodiment. Right, that in a sense, the aspiration is always to go beyond, and to go beyond in a way that enables you to get closer to a kind of comprehensive understanding of reality. To get to the God's point of view. Okay, and this is where I think the theology should never be forgotten in any of this, because there's a sense in which this whole dynamic that I'm talking about doesn't really make any sense unless you believe that there is this God who created the world on a plan, and in some sense we're privileged creations of that God, as in the Abrahamic tradition. If you don't have that kind of view to begin with, none of this stuff I'm talking about really makes much sense. And this is despite the fact that a lot of these people are atheists. But I don't think how you motivate what I'm talking about this aspirationalism of going beyond the body, unless you have the theology there, okay? And as you know, with regard to the Enlightenment movement, which I think if you don't like what I'm talking about, the people to blame are the Enlightenment people, okay? Because they did believe very strongly that there was a certain human capacity of reason, and that their problem was not that we have a capacity for reason, but the fact is that under the sort of political theological regimes that existed at the time, only a few people were able to exercise it freely. Right? So in other words, there was this understood species capacity for reason, which, you know, in Marx becomes translated into labor, right? This is a distinctive feature that distinguishes, you know, so we can create value because of our labor, right? Is in a way a materialist version of the Enlightenment idea that we have some special understanding of reality because of our reason. Right, so there's this distinctive thing that human beings have, and that the main problem was a very kind of pedestrian political problem that only the church, only the politicians actually were able to exercise this freely, and everybody else had to listen to them. So it was a revolt against hierarchy. But the idea that human beings are special and are privileged and have some sort of godlike access potentially to reality, that was still there with the Enlightenment people. Okay? So that's why I always find very odd, you know, you think about these latter-day new atheist types like Christopher Hitchens, recently deceased. He loves talking about Thomas Paine and reason and all this kind of thing, and that we shouldn't believe what the religious people say. I say, yeah, but from a Darwinian standpoint, it's not clear what reason means. And it's not clear that it's adaptively good. Okay, if we're talking about thinking about things way beyond the environmental context in which one normally survives, what is the point of thinking about transcendental numbers and non-Euclidean geometry and thinking in some way that we should be creating physical spaces that make these sorts of things possible? How does this increase the likelihood that we're going to survive as the material creatures that we were born into? Okay? Now, luckily, Thomas Paine didn't have to deal with this problem. But it seems to be now, right, as science has developed, we have come up with with capacities, with forms of reasoning, forms of understanding the world that take us way beyond our bodies. And it's, of course, in a material level, one of the things that have motivated the space program, for example. What's the big fuss about going into space, right? I mean, I think this is a great litmus test for whether you're a real Darwinist. If you're a real Darwinist, you think all the space stuff is bullshit. It's a waste of time, a waste of money. We shouldn't be... Why? Why bother? Who cares what happens in Mars? Why does this bother from the standpoint of human survival? There are a lot more immediate problems. Right? From a scientific standpoint, if you're prioritizing what it is that you want to do your research in with regard to science, why would you put a lot of value in the space program? Well, it's only because obviously we don't think of ourselves as just creatures bound by Earth. Okay? We think of ourselves as having this kind of cosmic dimension. So it's this issue of self-transcendence, okay, that then has to somehow be explained or justified and so forth. And I think, you know, from a political standpoint, if you look at the history of politics, right, and you get back down to Earth and you're not talking about going to Mars or Alpha Centauri or any place like that, right, the difference between the left and the right becomes very relevant here, even in the historical context in which this thing arose in the late 18th century. And as you know, probably it was as a result of the seating arrangements at the National Assembly right after the French Revolution, where you had the so-called left sitting on the left of the people defending the status quo and the so-called right sitting on the right. Now, the right consisted of people who were the defenders of the king and the church. And they are the status quo, and they, so in other words, the people ruling the country and the people legitimating the rule of the country. Okay? Now, on the left, in a very undifferentiated way, from at least our standpoint today, right, are the people we would call liberals and socialists. And they were undifferentiated back then. Because what they denied together was the idea that the past was some sort of direct indicator of how the future should be. But they denied it in different ways, as became more and more evident as the 19th century went on. But they were united in that point. In other words, there is no straight induction, you might say, from the past to the future. Right? And that is because they basically denied the way in which legitimacy was being transferred. Whether we're talking about inheritance of property, or we're talking about the Pope or the Bishop or whatever having to say this is the rightful successor of the country, right? They were denying all that. They were basically saying that the past does not determine the future. And this is why there was this interest in democracy and voting and, you know, in a way opening up the future. But the liberals and the socialists opened up the future in rather different ways, which I think became more and more evident as the 19th century went on. The liberals were very much concerned about keeping, you might say, and I think this is true today as well, that as a regulative ideal, you want to keep the future permanently open. Okay, so there is a value in freedom and openness in its own right. Now, what I mean by that is, as opposed to the idea that we're heading somewhere radically more positive, whether we have, you know, so we have a kind of concrete goal, as it were, that we're working our way toward, a kind of teleological conception of political destiny that will, as it were, fully realize the human potential in some real sense. And I think that's what the socialist project, you know, when it has distinguished itself most clearly from the liberal project, has been about that, right? That there is a, you might say, a political realism in the sense of there being a fact of the matter, a goal state that we're aiming toward with our politics, which is socialist. Whereas with the liberals, you might say there's a kind of anti-realist. There is no fact of the matter, as it were, as to what the best society is. But there is a value in people deciding at the moment, from moment to moment, what the best society is. And so we might, now how do they decide is an interesting question within the history of liberalism, right? Because you might say, okay, you decide these matters primarily in terms of voting in elections, okay? But you might also say you decide these matters in terms of the market. Right, and these and elections and markets are really two quite different institutional structures within which one might maintain an open-ended future. And of course they do in fact have different consequences. Okay? But it seems to me the liberal tradition is committed to that, a kind of anti-realism with regard to the ultimate political goals. And that's because they take seriously the fact that freedom is the value, and that the essence of the human, you might say, is that we are unbounded. We have these possibilities that are always open, right? And so the image here is you got to think about what's the contrast. The contrast ontologically is with animals. Animals are limited by their environment, right? So you, in a way, you have to imagine a kind of 18th century view, right? Where animals are determined by what they have been born. They don't have a lot of space for maneuvering. They can't just reinvent themselves and recreate themselves. But human beings can in a quite radical way. And maintaining that radical possibility for recreativity is what makes us human. And so this is where the liberal project gets off the ground, is with that. Okay? Now, you know, now as a matter of fact, of course, you know, you see what happens in the course of the history of liberalism. It's not a completely glorious story by any means. After all, we have neoliberalism now, right? Which in a way is free and not free at the same time. Okay, so I'm not saying that this thing has been kind of realized, but I do think that one, you know, when one distinguishes socialism from liberalism, which I, you know, it, which is often very hard to do, well, historically has always been hard to do, I do think the issue has to do with the realism issue. Namely, is there a goal that you're going toward? Do you have a do you have a sense of a goal? You know, and this is why the idea of having the ideal utopian society as an image is a very much part of the sort of socialist discourse in a way that it's not with liberalism. Okay? And that's because there's a sense in which socialism, you see, one of the things that I think socialism does take quite seriously is that the idea that if you want to reach someplace that's more desirable, there's a sense in which a lot of the things that we have to do in the meanwhile might not look so good. So it's not like we're always going to be going from strength to strength to strength to strength. There will be some problems, there will be some difficulties, it won't be perfect. And I think the idea with socialism is that you keep the ideal in mind of what the ideal state is, and that then enables you to tolerate all the stuff you have to go through in the middle, maybe through several generations of what's wrong. Okay? And so, of course, you know, when one thinks about, you know, sort of the... libertarians and these very radical kinds of liberals who kind of are very much opposed to socialism at a principled level, right, they will point to the fact that if you look at all of these atrocities having been done in the name of science in the 20th century, you know, whether we're talking about the atomic bomb or we're talking about eugenics or any of that kind of stuff, those things would not really have been made possible were it not for the collectivization of power and resources and so forth. So isn't that a damning critique of socialism in its own right? Okay? So, you know, we were mentioning yesterday Paul Feyerabend, right? Paul Feyerabend, the anything goes guy, right? One of the things that he was very much against socialism in the sense that I was talking about now. That I'm talking about now, right? He was against the idea of there being a fixed goal, a kind of project that would actually justify the mobilization of resources so that people would be focused on working on a certain kind of specific outcome, okay? And it wasn't just because it constrained human freedom, but even as an empirical matter, when you do concentrate the resources, you end up having these disastrous consequences. And so the way to remove that kind of normative burden would be to decentralize support for science, deconcentrate supports for science, have a kind of anarcho-libertarian sort of approach to science, where science is relative to the various communities that pursue it, but that with the understanding that there would never be a kind of state or anything that could concentrate the resources to push things forward, because that would lead to disaster. Okay? And I think that's the way to think about Feyerabend, it seems to me. That in a sense, he's this very radical liberal. Right? Very anti-socialist, very radical liberal kind of person. And that the reason why we have this kind of, you might say, hegemonic view of science is because the state has backed it, and the state has backed it for collectivist goals. And even though it may not call itself socialist, it nevertheless has the same ontology behind it. That there is this kind of collective project of what the society should be about, and it should be moving forward, and that science is the primary way of doing it, and so that the state then becomes the monopoly supporter of science. Okay? And it seems to me that this is kind of where the ideology of the science and politics on the left left us pretty much at the end of the 20th century. Okay, where you ended up having, you know, both sides of the socialist and liberal spectrum, and really that's the spectrum that I think is real, from my own standpoint, is the spectrum I'm really concerned with, is the liberal-socialist issue here. And then the question becomes, okay, what is, what do we think about science, and how exactly should we figure in our politics? Now, I've drawn this distinction between the proactionary and precautionary imperatives. Now, the precautionary imperative basically says the best thing that science can do for us now is to provide the kind of empirical data of telling us when we have gone too far. Right? So in other words, science is a critical check on our ambitions. So science tells us when things go wrong, and as a result, science can provide a kind of framework to make us more cautious, realize just all the problems that could potentially lie ahead, right? So sometimes people in this kind of mood, and it's very common now, you know, we have this great uncertain discourse of uncertainty that's floating around, that's been very much part of the sort of whatever post-normal, post-modern, post-whatever reality that we supposedly live in, and that's very much of that nature, right? That there's a sense in which we live in an uncertain world. Well, how do we know we live in an uncertain world? Well, you look at all these things that have happened in the past where people have tried to do one thing and something else happens. And sometimes very bad. So we ought to be very cautious, right? And so the precautionary imperative sees itself as very much responsive to the history of science in that sense, right? That what does science tell us about, you know, our understanding of the world? Well, it tells us that when we really take science very seriously and we try to, as it were, mobilize policy behind it in this kind of, you know, univocal fashion, we end up with lots of disasters. That's kind of the lesson, right? That we have to proceed very cautiously. And that's the precautionary imperative. Okay? Now, the thing here is that this kind of attitude cuts across traditional right-left lines, just like the proactionary imperative will as well. Okay? So, for example, with a precautionary imperative, you can imagine, for example, people who have very kind of traditionalist anti-science views, you know, a certain kind of religious person, maybe a person who takes Karl Barth too seriously from a theological point of view, right, who sort of believes science is the devil, right, and there's a sense in which religion doesn't have to do any kind of negotiation with science, that it's just believing in what the truth is of the gospel and just keeping apart from science, you'll be saved. And those people will be very precautionary, right? They will not be supporting any transhumanist projects, any eugenics projects, anything of that sort, right? They will be very cautious, very conservative. And of course, you got a lot of these people who were in George W. Bush's bioethics council a few years ago, right? Who ended up banning stem cell research, you know, at the federal level, at the United States. States could do it individually, but the federal government would not fund stem cell research in the United States. And there's a secular way of talking about this kind of theological aversion, you might say, where in some sense science is just, you know, the devil incarnate, by talking about the yuck factor. I don't know if you've run across this. Let me just, it's a sort of English idiom. The yuck factor, gross, right? I mean, the idea being that a lot of the things that are being proposed in terms of stem cell research, in terms of a lot of the biological research that would sort of extend the human condition, involve violating our kind of our sense of what's appropriate or not. It really gets into very sort of moral sentiments in a way. And that revulsion, that disgust that we have toward these developments should somehow be taken as ontologically significant. Okay, so there's a secular version of what I think is ultimately a kind of theological aversion to moving forward on a lot of these matters. Okay, so that comes, from a kind of religious side. But then there is also what I was just alluding to earlier on the precautionary side, coming from people like Feyerabend, who aren't religious people, who in a sense believe that in a sense the kind of big science conceptions of how science can transform us and transform society are basically authoritarian. Right? So in other words, that in a sense, whatever knowledge that we produce as scientists or whatever should be done at a level relative to particular communities that the particular communities want. And so whatever you want to call it, multicultural, decentralized, deconcentrated, right? That's the level at which, in fact, decisions about knowledge should be made for the people who have to live with the consequences most directly with them. And so there is a kind of political argument at the secular level, which is associated with a certain brand of the left, a kind of communitarian brand of the left, right? Which basically is anti-statist, right? Where the problem is the state, right? And basically wants knowledge to be relative to communities, relative to groups, and so forth. Okay? So the precautionary principle actually gains mileage from both sides of these issues that in the older political spectrum would have been seen as right versus left. Okay, so that's the precautionary side. Now the proactionary side, which is the side that I actually support, and so I put this forward as a partisan here, and I do think, and I'll just make a kind of advertisement here for what it means to be a professor, because I do think it's important to always tell people what's the value of being a professor in a context like this, is that we can't be fired for saying these things. Right? So, now, I really think that's the main issue here, right? The tenure issue, the fact that you can put forward radical positions and lay out radical possibilities with impunity, right? People may condemn you in journals and newspapers and whatever, but the fact that you can still teach the next day and do research the next day is a very important part, right? So I'm not sure I want to recommend to everybody in the audience, do this on your own kind of thing. I do think it has to do with institutional security. But I will say right now, I think the proactionary side, the side I'm going to talk about now, is the right side of this issue. Okay? And this is kind of what I would regard as the new left, but it combines elements of the libertarian right. Okay? And what elements of the libertarian right are we talking about here? And that's the idea of, and this brings up the issue of risk. Okay? And I think the politics of the future, in terms of how you define, because, if you think about it, back in 1789, the left-right distinction was defined in terms of whether you were for or against the status quo, in terms of how the institutions in the society were being reproduced. That was kind of what the issue was about. But now it seems to me that the right-left of the future will be in terms of your attitudes toward risk, whether you're risk-seeking or risk-averse. Okay? Because everybody grants there's uncertainty. Uncertainty is kind of a given now, right? I mean, in the way in which determinism may have been a given in the late 19th century, now in the beginning of the early 21st century, everybody grants uncertainty. The question is whether uncertainty is a threat or an opportunity. Really? That is what we're talking about here, right? So forget, everybody talks about uncertainty. That's banal. That's given. Right? The question is, what's your attitude toward it? Is it something you embrace? Or is it something that you're afraid of? Okay? And I do think this is the issue here. Risk-seeking versus risk-averse. And risk-seeking is the left and risk-averse is the right. Okay? Now, the way I've described this in some of the works I've written on this is as a kind of 90-degree change in the political spectrum, right? So in other words, we have things at right angles. So some of the stuff that was in the right now becomes part of the left and vice versa. Okay, so that's kind of how rotating the axis 90 degrees is how I think about what's going on here. But I do think that this is kind of the kind of world that we're entering into. And it does have a lot to do, I have to say, in terms of the way in which our collective philosophical anthropology has changed over the last 100 years, is the importance of two things. One of them is the importance of Darwinism, Okay? And I do think that the Darwinist position, one of the things that it's done in a very profound way to people, is to level the differences between ourselves and animals. And where a lot of these kind of very traditional notions about there being reason and objectivity and all of these mental powers that in the past were seen as distinguishing humans from animals, even without the theology, so let's say during the Enlightenment, that the salience of that is disappearing to a large extent. Right? And so that in a sense, the difference between humans and animals, whether we're talking about, you know, logic or language or whatever, is seen as much more a matter of degree than kind. And I think that's a very important influence that Darwinism has had, a very subtle kind of influence, maybe. It's not necessarily the people who believe in this continuity, subscribe to everything that Richard Dawkins says, for example. But nevertheless, there has been this erosion of the difference, you know, between our being rational and our being sentient, for example. I think that distinction has greatly eroded. The intuitions aren't so strong anymore, as I think were, I mean, I think they were much stronger even when I was a student, but I don't think they're so strong anymore. I think one really needs to make the argument almost from scratch that there are distinctive powers that human beings have. Okay? And I think from that standpoint, and this is where naturalism, I think, has been triumphant in a way, right? Naturalism as a sort of philosophical idea has been triumphant, is the sense that you put all the people who want to argue for the distinctiveness of the human on the back foot, whether they're secular or theological, right? You have to somehow kind of think about, well, what is it that distinguishes us, right? And so we might, and this is where certain kinds of answers about our social organization, our capacity to lift off from the planets, our capacity to get, you know, to transform our consciousness into computers, all of this becomes a way of trying to answer that question. But there is a kind of default sensibility, I think, that is increasing in the culture that human beings are just animals. And this is where the precautionary principle becomes so important, is in that context. The precautionary principle would look incredibly fearful and kind of, you know, unattractive if we didn't actually have a kind of Darwinian backdrop against which we say, yeah, we might think we're so smart, but look, you know, as we know from the history of biology, natural history, we know that every species has been here, just about every one of them has disappeared after a while. Especially the ones that were very distinctive in terms of their functions and things. Right? They disappear after a while. Right? And so again, induction, right? You say, well, it's going to happen to us too. Okay? And the precautionary principle, I think, really takes off once you take that idea as quite salient in terms of how you understand a human being. Okay? And again, this has nothing to do with accepting very deep ideas about Darwinism or genetics or anything of that sort, but has to do with accepting kind of the metaphysical premise of the Darwinian position. That kind of naturalism, I think, will incline people to precautionary position, which means that the burden of proof is very much on the proactionary side. So I recently did a Google search about proactionary and precautionary in terms of how many hits there are for these terms. And the ratio is 50 to 1. 50 to 1. Precautionary over proactionary. Okay? So the proactionary principle, if you want to put it as a kind of philosophical, metaphysical point, is that basically is not to deny what Darwinists say about the composition of the human being, that yes, our genomes are 95, 97, 99% overlap with other animals. No, we're not denying that point. But to say that's not where the essence of the human resides. Okay? That there's a sense in which there's a contingency that the human is the product of this biological evolution. Not just in the sense that some other organism could have been developed, but rather the fact that humans have come about through this process doesn't mean that humans have to continue that way in the future. Okay? So it's contingency about the future in a very radical sense. And this is where a lot of the Kurzweil arguments come in, right? So you think about the transhumanist projects. What are they about? They are about going against the grain of biological evolution in various ways, from relatively moderate versions to extreme versions. Extreme version, of course, is to say the human being is really, the real human being is pure mind, rationality, intelligence. That's what we're really about. What distinguishes us most from the animals is what really we are. So the distinctive quality is the essential quality. Okay? In which case, if you have that kind of metaphysical view, you're quite happy to entertain the idea that the carbon basis on which we operate, which is the product of all these billions of years of evolution, might not be required, in some sense, if we're smart enough to get ourselves into something more durable that can actually amplify what it is that distinguishes us from the other animals. And this is what the Kurzweil thing ultimately is a metaphysical proposition. Okay? Take this seriously, right? I think this idea wouldn't have any legs at all if it weren't for the theology, to be perfectly honest, because you have to somehow believe, wow, this sort of human capacity is this amazing thing, and you have to think about it being godlike in a way. I think if you don't think of it as being godlike, it's hard to motivate it. But the point is that if you do, if you're willing to entertain this, right, that's the way you go on this. Who says that just because we are the products of 4 billion years of evolution that we have to continue that way? Could we not transfer what we think is most distinctive and valuable about ourselves into some other medium? Okay? And that's the radical version of the proactionary approach, radical version. There are more moderate versions. They're the, you know, you may know that there are people like, for example, in Britain, we've got this guy, Britain, by the way, is the great homeland for transhumanism. We got all the crazies. Aubrey de Grey, who believes that in principle we in our biological bodies, so he's not talking about putting us into computers, but that our biological bodies, if we just switch some genes on and off in various ways, we could live for 1,000 years. Okay? Now, obviously, that's not something that the evolution is likely to come up with very soon. But it's something he thinks, you know, we could do with our understanding of the genome and biomedicine and all the rest of it. And there's still, you know, more, you know, and eugenics, you might say, the kind of 20th century style projects in eugenics are sort of very moderate in relation to all this, in terms of how much human beings can be changed. Because most 20th century projects of eugenics, as you may know, were before the era of molecular biology and that revolution with the DNA. So it was really about manipulating populations at a very gross level. So saying if people have certain kinds of traits, we don't allow them to reproduce. Okay, so it's a population genetics kind of approach to the issue. But now we can talk about this at the molecular level, and potentially we might be able to talk about this beyond that. Okay, now all of this whole side of the issue, okay, is presupposes a great faith in science, but also a great knowledge of how science has in various respects failed in the past. So it involves a great sort of tolerance for error, for mistakes, for problems, okay? And so you end up, you know, in principle, what you end up having in a way that really didn't exist in the 20th century is, on the one hand, you can imagine this, I mean, the natural homeland for this is, you know, entrepreneurs, right? People who are entrepreneurs, and Ray Kurzweil, it should never be forgotten, is a guy who basically is able to talk about this stuff because he invented a speech recognition technology in the late 1970s that made him a load of money, on the basis of which, then, he has been able to promote this. So the idea of being entrepreneurial, and the whole idea of an entrepreneur is taking risks, you know, going in places, you know, pushing the boundaries, and seeing what benefits you can get from it. That kind of attitude is very much part of what the proactionary perspective is about. It does involve this very strong risk-seeking attitude. Okay, one of the things here, in terms of thinking about that side of the issue, is, I don't know, those of you in philosophy know that when we talk about risk and uncertainty, we often talk about risk as something that you can calculate, whereas uncertainty is something you cannot calculate. That's kind of a very standard thing when you study statistics, at least from a philosophy standpoint. Now, this kind of way of looking at things is due to one of the guys who's very much responsible for the kind of view of the entrepreneur that I'm putting forward here. And it's a guy called Frank Knight, who is usually seen as the founder of the Chicago School, but that was before there was any Chicago School to talk about. So he's a kind of like forefather, you might say. So Frank Knight basically was arguing that the point about the entrepreneur was that this was a person who, in a sense, took risks in a blind sense, in a sense that he didn't know in advance. So the person obviously has some capital to begin with, but doesn't know what the profit and loss is likely to be. Because, in a sense, moving into a terrain that hasn't been encountered before, taking a very big risk. But then after that risk has been taken, and it's been successful, then one can talk about profit and loss. How much did it cost? What did you gain by it? And at that point, you end up into having the possibility for managers and firms and all of these kinds of institutional character business that we think about when we think about the business world. Okay? So there's a sense in which there's this kind of original creative mode, which is what Frank Knight associated with uncertainty. Uncertainty is blind. You jump into it. People who jump into it typically have some capital, but they don't know what the loss or gain is going to be, and it's only in retrospect that you know it's been a success or failure. And the key thing about succeeding in business for him, and I think this would be true also for any kind of politics of this, is that you keep a track record. What worked, what didn't work. You do diagnostics, okay? And this was part of what he was talking about. But you don't know in advance. So there's a sense in which the proactionary people are exactly like the precautionary principle in people in believing, yes, you don't know what the future is going to be like. But then there's a question of what your attitude toward that point is. And on the one hand, you could say, we're going to go for it, but we're also going to keep track of what happens. We're not going to hide the consequences. Right? And this has been one of the problems, I think, with a lot of what one might call proactionary stuff that took place in the name of government over the course of the 20th century, was that very often a lot of things were hidden. So it wasn't possible to learn from the mistakes. Okay? Things are hidden. And to this day, there's still this problem. But the idea was that results would be known, and then people would be able to judge where to go from there. So there would be some knowledge gained in the process, even if this kind of proactionary movement turns out to be a failure. Okay, that there's at least a learning experience. Now, people like Karl Popper and others, of course, you know, in a sense, this is kind of their idea of the scientific method is very much along these lines, right? But it requires a couple of things that I think is going to be a very big challenge for politics, I think, including for the people who are on the proactionary side, namely, it's not just a matter of encouraging risk-taking, okay, but it's also a matter of keeping public what the consequences of those risks taken are. Because otherwise there is no learning experience. There is no sense in which you're actually moving any kind of trajectory forward. So in other words, the failures and the nature of the failures have to be registered in a public way. Now this, in fact, is a very big legal problem. And the tendency now, I would say, with institutional review boards and so forth, with regard to scientific research, is to be very precautionary, right? In other words, not to allow at the outset research that could possibly have bad consequences. Whereas what I'm arguing with the proactionary side is the opposite. Namely, you allow the research, but on the condition that all of the negative consequences are there publicly. And then one can move on from there. Now, I think this kind of public declaration of error and failure, which I think will be inevitably part of any kind of proactionary principle, right, will require certain kinds of legal protections for the people who commit the errors. Okay? And that's the tricky part. What is the nature of the legal protections for those people? And what is the nature of the compensation for the people, you know, if we're talking about human issues, who turn out to, as it were, voluntarily involve themselves in these experiments that are allowed, that have all these disastrous consequences. What is the compensation? How do you deal with that? So there's a whole issue of from the legal side about enabling a kind of proactionary society to happen. Okay? And I actually see this in the context of a renewed understanding of the welfare state. Because the problem with the welfare state in the past has been that it's been very much oriented toward protecting people when they're weak. Where the idea should be to empower people and protect them once they've exhibited strength but failed. Okay, so there's a sense in which one needs to think about, so I'm talking about a kind of legal system for a new sort of welfare state, but one that doesn't have the same sort of normative orientation of the past. Okay? And I think this is kind of, I do think that, to be honest with you, I think this is kind of where the political direction is going. My basis for thinking this is, I think the younger generation of people, first of all, don't vote, don't relate to traditional right-left perspectives, but do relate to the kinds of issues that I'm talking about as precautionary and proactionary. In other words, we have a large bunch of people of the younger generation who are very devoted to the environment, very devoted to environmental concerns, want, you know, break into the animal labs, you know, and all this kind of thing, and basically believe that, you know, the world ought to be governed in a cause no harm principle. Cause no harm is the ultimate principle. There's a lot of people out there like that. Okay? And for me, that's the new right. The new left is going to be to accept harm, but at a cost, under certain kinds of conditions. But to move forward. Okay? And it involves a redefinition of what it means to be human, because I do think that this kind of enlightenment notion that we got, you know, Kant maybe exemplifies it the most, that in some sense a human being is part rational, part animal, that's pulling apart. That's pulling apart. That the center doesn't hold in that respect, right? And there's some people who say we ought to be repatriated with nature, and others saying we should push away from nature more. Okay, and I think the new left, the new right, and new left will be along that kind of issue. And I'll stop there to take some questions and discussions. But the point I would stress with regard to science is both sides are pro-science in the sense that both sides are using science. Both sides have an understanding of science and an understanding of the history of science that is adequate, right? In the sense that they do. It's not like we're talking about scientifically illiterate versus scientifically literate. No, no. They're reading the history of science, but they're drawing different conclusions from it. And I think this is kind of where we are at the moment. Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, so questions, comments, personally?
So maybe I start, so I'm going to summarize anyway at the moment, so I can start with a small challenge. Because if I summarize you correctly, you say take risks, keep the future open, keep track records.
Yes.
And have a legal safeguard, safety net for those who do it. So then I assume you must be very happy in Europe, given that the public pays for failures or errors of bankers, right? Is that approximately then the goal? Because just as an example, right?
Well,
yeah,
I know. I've been asked this question before. No, I've been asked this question before, and at a certain, I mean, I think there's a, because look, the way in which we deal with the bankers is quite complex. Because, for example, in the UK, we're still allowing the bankers to get big bonuses on the back of this, and that's one sort of way of doing this. But and I'm not necessarily supporting that. But I do think that we do need to support the banking system to be able to take the risks. Maybe not necessarily in the way that governments have done it, which have involved these, you know, allowing all these big bonuses to happen to bankers even though the banks have failed. But I do think there's a sense in which we do need to continue to maintain a risk-taking environment.
Okay.
So I'm not necessarily endorsing the particular political proposals, but I do think the general idea. So I'm against, let's say, some of the Austrian economics people who say, let the banks fail. Banks are bad to begin with. Okay? I mean, because I don't know if you realize that the Austrian economic, I mean, some of you may think this is a leftist idea, but it's very much part of the libertarian right idea as well, to let the banks fail. Okay? And I'm not for that. No. I do think we need to encourage a climate of risk-taking.
Okay.
It's just how we do it exactly. I think that's where the issue arises.
May I add a second question?
Sure.
Because you seem to imply that the precautionary principle is one principle. And if you look at it in detail, it's a very different principle. They range from you focus on worst case scenario to take decisions, all the way to as soon as there's some possible evidence of harm, you take precautionary action. So there's a whole area, you know, right from the Bio Declaration to what Frankfurt.
Sure.
So it's really a bandwidth things that you have. And that's quite, I'm not sure whether, I'm asking whether you're aware of it, because what I find quite interesting is the work of Christian List and others, who basically say that instead of taking the precautionary principle as a decision instrument, you should build it into the modeling phase. So instead of taking precautionary principle as something that you did in decision making, you do it into modeling before taking decisions. So I'm just wondering.
Yeah, you know, as I was saying in some of my late final remarks about the welfare state, okay, there's a sense in which this kind of renewed welfare state, in a sense, anticipating there will be failure, and then protecting against those failures in various ways, is a kind of precautionary move incorporated into that. So but I do think the spirit of the precautionary principle. So I don't deny that there's a sense in which you can incorporate a precautionary idea into this kind of larger framework. In fact, otherwise you wouldn't have a welfare state, basically, right? I mean, you wouldn't have any welfare state at all if you weren't willing to take some precautionary idea seriously. But the problem is whether the precautionary idea becomes kind of the overriding regulative ideal of everything. And I do think that in fact, has been proposed. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the United States had all these problems with the Rio Declaration in 1992, right? Where they said precautionary, because the idea of saying there was a precautionary principle with regard to the environment suggested the legal systems had to conform to that in some kind of direct way, as opposed to a kind of precautionary approach, which then could be implemented at whatever level was seen to be appropriate by the national governments. So it's not that black and white in that sense, but I do think where the ideological struggle comes in, right, in terms of what it is, the kind of world that people are envisioning would be on the back of a precautionary principle. That's the kind of level at which I'm arguing.
Thanks for the talk. There were so many ideas, many things so much that I don't know if I'll be able to make just a question that makes sense, because everything is like there. But the thing that it brings to my mind, in general, what you said, is a sentence by Goya, the famous Spanish painter, that is, the dream of reason produces monsters.
Yeah.
And then I think of enlightenment, idea of progress, that seems that you are holding on, and they have like a question, if the technical progress and the epistemological progress, in their own terms, it would bring more progress. And the conclusion quite obvious was that no. Then when we talk about this, reactionary principle, are taking risks, evolving in our own terms, lead by our craving of godness or transcendence. So it's like we're just grasping this idea of technological progress, but we are disregarding that even if we are in the 21st century and we have been progressing amazingly in the last centuries, morally, we are just terribly as we were before, or even worse, because this progress gave us the opportunity to test what enlightenment asked, that if we have the media, I mean the sources, to avoid poverty or slavery or all these suffering conditions of people, if we could really increase the happiness and the welfare of people. And the reply is no, clearly. Actually, we use that knowledge in order to manipulate people, to make them unhappy, so they consume more, and they will bring more power to people who is already poor. So then, when you talk about the aims of people and our divine aims and so, I kind of like that personally. But to use it as a social source of motivation or legitimacy, I think that is, well, I see many thoughts on that, but the main one would be that is like if this epistemological record of that brings us to this conclusion that we really want to transcend ourselves is like the version, epistemological version of the history by the winners. So maybe 5% or, I don't know, or 10 or maybe just one of population really have that that need to transcend, you know, to be like on the top of Monroe's part. But maybe 90% of people, they just want to be happy, they just struggle every day. And this production, I think, transhumanism, I don't know, put it ending so we can communicate or have internet, just a person, on the face and you are connected to someone else, it's not going to solve the problems. So, I mean, this is going to satisfy the craving for knowledge and to satisfy the curiosity of some people that really the intellectual part is really powerful and drives it somehow can drive humanity to evolve, society to evolve. Right. But it's not going to cover all those reports. Well, I stop there because
these are good points. Okay, I'm gonna address them in some sort of order. The first point is, I think the way to think about, there are some practical political problems here that I want to just put on the table. Some of you who are familiar with the kinds of discourses I'm talking about will know about this immediately. That the transhumanists and the proactionary people tend to be libertarians. So in the sense they don't care about what 95% of the population think. And that's a big problem with regard to the proactionary imperative as a kind of political principle. Okay, I find it quite odd, to be honest with you. But I do think my own view is that actually that this is a project that will really become, they'll get some political mileage once states start to adopt it. And I think that the spirit in which they need to adopt it is kind of like, look, There was a debate that took place in the late 18th, early 19th century about whether what was the value of people learning how to read and having to go to school. Okay? I mean, they have perfectly good lives, they're perfectly happy and so forth without having to deal with these books and filling out these forms and all this kind of bureaucracy that was going to end up governing their lives and so forth. You see, and the argument was by the people who were defending the state at the time was that in fact people will be able to realize their full potential. They'll be able to be full participants in society. They'll be able to interact in all kinds of ways they couldn't before if they actually have these kinds of particular, admittedly low tech but technological skills: writing, reading, so forth. Okay, and so this is the reason why the government should mandate public education. Okay, but they were perfectly happy before they had it, and it took a lot of grief to actually get that going. Okay, so the point is, it'd be interesting to see where you would have been in that argument back then. What would have been your position back in the late 18th? No, because I do think it's an analogous situation that we have now, that in a sense, the proactionary people are the people who are saying that because you're not thinking about all these other possibilities out there, you're restricting your possibilities for self-fulfillment. So you can't reach that, you know. So in other words, the Maslow thing isn't some secret, right? You were talking about the Maslow pyramid, right, where you have the highest needs being realized. That's not some secret that just the 5% of the population have to have. Everyone could have that in principle, right? That could be a political project, right? And that is very much like the project of having public education in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in Europe, okay? And I'm saying this would be something like that. It would be, the arguments would be analogous to that. But you're absolutely right that just like in the late 18th and early 19th century, people were perfectly happy being illiterate. Karl Marx used to make fun of them routinely. Okay? Karl Marx would make fun of such people that you love.
No.
Yes, he would. No, the point is, no, I'm sorry, but the point is, it is the same.
It's a white and black thing. So, but I'm like kind of gray.
No, but the point is, I don't. The fact that people would find it uncomfortable or they can live perfectly normal lives in a certain way isn't an argument in its own right. People can live quite well in all kinds of conditions We see that all the time. I mean, this is where the normative issue comes up. Is the normative issue, is the normative problem of how human beings live just settled by whatever they can put up with? So if they tolerate it, it's fine.
No, please.
No, but I want to. Can I continue? Because that's only one point she raised.
Okay, but
But she was right. Because you were raising a lot of very good points. A short point about the divine stuff. Again, I'm not sure how familiar people would be, but the idea of connecting the theological stuff with the technological stuff is actually. Pretty straightforward historically. If you think about human beings identifying themselves with their technology, why does that happen? As opposed to identifying ourselves with animals. Well, a lot has to do with the idea of human beings thinking of themselves as creators just like God. Okay? And that our machines, insofar as our machines can transform the environment, we're doing God-like things that way. Okay? So the idea of identifying the unique human capacity with technology to begin with is a theological idea. It's one that you do see in the Middle Ages very strongly. I mean, one historian who's written about this, David Noble, some of you will know, at York University, the religion of technology. He's very critical of all this, of course, but he's right, I think, in terms of seeing that there's a theological, that it's not, because if you're wondering why do human beings identify more with their technology than they do with the animals, it's because of that. Namely, they think of themselves as creators, and they're very impressed by the machines they've created, which they think are kind of microcosms of how the creator operates in the world at large. Okay, so I do think there is this very strong historical connection between the theology and the technology. Okay, so that there's that point there. The business, the very first point you were raising about that we have all this scientific progress and everybody's miserable. I think that's a real open question, but there's also the issue of what is the time horizon in terms of which one is thinking about all this? Because there is a sense in which, and I'm not going to deny it, the proactionary imperative is very much no pain, no gain, right? So there's always going to be a sense of short-term problems. The Industrial Revolution was a big short-term problem for a lot of people, okay? It's still a problem for a lot of people. Right, I do think that there's a sense in which before one can make judgments about whether something has been a net benefit or loss, one does need some proper accounting, cost accounting here, and I do think that that is in a sense what I'm appealing to, namely that yes, it's not a complete positive, but when you do the balance sheet, it's more positive than negative.
But it's the problems we already have, not the ones we are going to create related to the movement.
You can keep maybe this because we have two more questions and we are out of time. So we just have 5 minutes for two questions, right? And we can go for a coffee at 10:30 and then okay. But very short, please. I will ask you, Ariana.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Fabrice. But very short. I will ask you just
two questions.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe just the first one. It's a little bit following this point that. It was interesting how you frame the debate between a precautionary and proactive principle of imperative, especially connected with the political stuff, and with what you classify as new right and new left. We should frame it under the label of risk, risk acceptance, or risk averseness. The thing is that if you frame like this, it becomes very abstract and decontextualized. So I don't know who is having the cost of the risk, because you say the new left is the one who said we have to accept harm, no risk, no fun. But I have the impression, in order to stimulate and to be a little bit polemic, that the people arguing we should take a risk are the ones who are not having the pain. So, I mean, if you are just talking about the framework, about who is taking the risk and is a risk investment or risk or risk seeking, then the real question, the real political question is who is going to pay for the risk? And the problem is that you have a different, as you see, different concepts of good life in the society, and which are connected with, because there is nobody who is, I think that there are very less people thinking that we have, we can live in a world without risk. But the problem is who is taking the risk, and also, and especially about who is creating the risk. And the scientific enterprise is creating some risk, but for some parts of people in some specific context. So I have a problem with the framing this decontextualized, because otherwise you don't have the political attachment. And the other point was about Darwinism, because I have a little, a very different perception of what the main message of Darwinism is, because you said that if you accept the metaphysical concept of Darwinism, gradualism, then you stick to the precautionary side, and the proactive is more about underlying the contingency, about the future and the openness. But actually, if you read Darwin, there is the sense of evolution is contingency, because you said that we are products of billions of years of evolution, and why we should stick to this material condition. But precisely because we are products of evolution, we evolve through the time. And if you read the books of Darwin about man and the essence or the characteristic of the human beings, and moral and social sentiments and moral sense, and the fact that we are going beyond the struggle for life principle, so we are organizing a society with empathy, with helping the weak, which is a principle. There is a French philosopher who is interpreting that in the sense that is going against some principle of evolution. So I mean, in Darwin there is this sense of contingency and openness about the world. The thing is that transhumanist project or other scientific project are just arguing for contingency about the future and openness in a particular direction or in some particular direction, like for example anti-aging or uploading mind contents on software, etc. And these are particular version of this kind of contingency of human nature, but it's not the only thing. And this is go back to my previous point. So then you have to evaluate this solution, this interpretation about contingency of human nature in their political and economic context, and not just say these are the framework which are for risk and the other who are arguing against anti-aging project or whatever, they are risk averse, because maybe they are saying, okay, we don't want to go this way because we want to go other way, but it's not a matter of generality about risk.
Okay, I mean, well, thank you. First of all, because I was presenting ideological positions here, the abstractness was, I think, required to get the ideal types, you might say, of the positions clear. Of course, people occupy intermediate positions, but let me address the very specific points you made. First of all, you're absolutely right about the issue about who actually has to bear the cost of the pain of all this risk-taking. And this is where I do think a rethinking of what the welfare state is about would involve this kind of issue. So, for example, here's what I'm imagining: if we actually had a proactionary society, I actually don't imagine that most people would be taking major risks, okay, with drugs or treatments or whatever. I don't imagine that would happen. I imagine that there would be a few people who would do it. I mean, a few, maybe 10-20% maybe of the population. And that, as it were, they would be subsidized by the other 80-90% of the population who would potentially benefit by whatever was learned by those risks that were taken. Okay? That's kind of how I'm imagining the situation going, right? Where there would be a sense in which you don't imagine everybody's going to take the risks. Some people will be take the risk. There will be an encouragement to take the risk, but there will also be compensation. And the compensation will become from whatever additional taxes that the people who don't take the risks pay to take care of whatever has happened in the failed cases to the people who do take the risks. Okay, so I mean, I am sort of factoring that in. Pain is not the final word. There is possibility for compensation, okay? And I think I think that that's kind of the way in which I'm imagining this in more detail. But the other point you were raising about Darwin, and I think this is a very interesting point. One reason why I stressed in my talk that both the precautionary and the proactionary imperatives take uncertainty as a ground level assumption is to acknowledge the open-endedness stuff, okay? So in other words, open-endedness isn't the thing that distinguishes precautionary from proactionary. They both accept open-endedness. The attitude is, you know, it says, okay, we have an open-ended world, what do we do? Now, if you actually look at what Darwin's views were, okay, yes, Darwin believed we could evolve into something else and some of the species may come about, and in fact believed that our time was numbered on the Earth. I mean, all that is true, but Darwin did not support, for example, eugenics. He did not support Francis Galton. He didn't believe that human beings could ever control the evolutionary process in any kind of substantial way, and believed that, in fact, more harm would be caused. Okay? Because people would be forced into doing very unnatural things, that the benefits of which, who knows, right? So in other words, Darwin was very much a natural precautionary in that respect, okay? Very much unlike a lot of the other people, you know, if you think about Julian Huxley, for example, who's one of the authors of the evolutionary synthesis in the 1940s, okay? He said human beings were distinguished from other animals by virtue of our ability to comprehend the evolutionary process and take control of it. Now that's the man who coined the word transhumanism, Julian Huxley. But that's not Darwin's view, okay? And likewise, Darwin was very much a reluctant endorser of the vivisection movement, right? So we were hearing a little bit about this yesterday with regard to Claude Bernard, right? So in Britain, right, we do have this kind of a society for the prevention of cruelty to animals, which Jeremy Bentham, right? Jeremy Bentham is the great precursor of Peter Singer, right? You know, any entities that can feel pleasure and pain, they are entitled to some kind of legal protection. And so these people were arguing very much against the use of animals in experimentation in Britain. And Huxley, Thomas Henry Huxley, right, Darwin's bulldog, right, wrote to Darwin and said, you know, we need to have you support vivisection, animal experimentation. Darwin supported it, but very reluctantly, and you can tell from the correspondence that Darwin believed that the advantage that would be gained through animal experimentation was extremely limited and should always be dealt with in a way thinking about the cruelty to the animals. So in other words, Darwin had very limited view about the extent to which human beings could really improve themselves from the, you know, in terms of doing anything transcendent and so forth, okay? I mean, Darwin, I think, was a very precautionary guy by nature, unlike perhaps some of the other people who wanted to speak in his name.
Thank you. We are very, very late. If you promise me that you can ask the question in 1 minute, you yes. can.
Sure.
And if you That's also fine. Can answer it very, very shortly, yeah. we can right. do it but 2 minutes.
So you don't have to answer it. Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. I think it was very useful to have a better understanding of how the liberal aspects go, you know, towards the new left and so on.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. So I just have two quick remarks or questions, one about naturalism and the other one about yeah. use of knowledge. But naturalism, as you mentioned, there is an ontological component of it, an epistemological component. So on the ontological component, people are saying everything there is part of nature, and as such should be subsumed under natural laws. And on the epistemological side, people are saying everything we know we're taught by the natural sciences at some fundamental level, with the implication that everything we learn otherwise is purely instrumental,
uh-huh.
like mathematics.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me both things are doomed, completely wrong. I think it can be shown to be wrong. But so I wanted to know what is your stand on this issue, and it doesn't seem to me that you need any of these views to argue for the position you've been arguing for, that you don't have to argue with what people have been putting forward with naturalism. And the other question is about absolute knowledge. Okay, you mentioned the fact that we want to know everything. Okay, now we also know that we cannot get that. We cannot be assigned for, you know, there's various arguments, various reasons, and so on. And in a way, it's okay. I mean, there are things we don't care to know, things we know or, you know, could know, but we have. I mean, this issue about there's this issue about the hierarchy of things that are known. I mean, that also was present in theological debates. I mean, for example, God knows everything. Some actively, some passively, and there are things that, you know, he knows I had tea this morning, but it's, you know, completely uninteresting, and so forth, and so on. And so, now there are things that, presumably, it is rational for us that we wish we knew them, and once we consider the things that, you know, it's rational for us to aim at in terms of knowledge, there will be a hierarchy. I mean, there will be things that, you know, are more desirable than others, and so on. So do you think there could be a hierarchy, as it were, building within, as it were, a view from nowhere, some absolute hierarchy, or only hierarchies with respect to certain goals, political agendas, and so on? I mean, and there's also things that we wish we never knew. I mean, you think typically of the splitting of the atom, the genome project, and so on. I mean, a lot of people have been saying that it would be rational to aim for ignorance or to remain ignorant of certain things.
I don't hold that view.
Okay. So what do you think of this position? People saying, thank God we have cognitive limitations. There are things, you know, we wish we never, you know, better not know. So what is your...
Well, no, I don't hold that view. In a way, I'm a bit like Leibniz in this regard, that even the really bad things that we end up encountering and so forth are indicators of where the good should be. And in the sense that they're put there for a reason, you might say. I tend to be of that disposition, let's put it that way, with regard to that. So I think the problem that we do have as human beings in this kind of project of trying to know everything is that we don't actually keep a good track record. There is a tendency, once the bad things happen, to hide them, right? And not to really discuss them in a kind of open way where one thinks about the good and bad sides of even very atrocious things, okay? And I think that's the problem that human beings have, is that reluctance to deal with the really big mistakes in a very open and transparent fashion, okay? I think that's the bigger problem. I don't think there's an issue about whether there's certain things we shouldn't know and so forth. I don't believe that at all, okay? Now, with regard to naturalism, there's a sense in which it's a rhetorical move to start with naturalism, because I take that as a kind of default position, okay? But I do think that if one does believe that science is aiming at the truth, and that, in a sense, if science is aiming at the truth, then the truth applies reflexively, then if you end up coming up with conclusions, let's say from Darwinism, that implicates a certain view of the human being that ends up contradicting what enabled us to get to where we are now, in the sense, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Thomas Henry Huxley gave a very famous lecture at the end of his life called Evolution and Ethics, the Romaines Lecture in 1893 or 94. And he was basically saying it was really important that Newton had come before Darwin and not the other way around, because it wouldn't have happened. Okay? Because Newton, of course, has this very God-intoxicated view that science can understand the whole universe, get in the mind of God, all that kind of thing. And that was really very important for motivating the scientific enterprise to get us to where Darwin now. But now, at the end of the 19th century, the question is going to be, once we have this kind of demystified view of the human being, where we're just another animal, what would motivate us to continue doing anything like the Newtonian project? You see, and he said that was the big challenge for science continuing in the 20th century.
So, thank you very much. We have now a coffee break. We are back at 11, right? And we keep going with the PhD students.
Okay.